Chapter 7, Saints and Mystics. Biographies have always been one of my favourite forms of literature. It was therefore to be expected that I should have read, in the course of a long life, not only the lives of poets, painters and philosophers, but also those of Christian saints, mystics, visionaries and prophets. I did not read the biographies of these Christian worthies for the sake of spiritual uplift and illumination, though this did sometimes come, just as it sometimes came when I read the lives of great poets, painters and philosophers. I read their biographies because they were remarkable men and women whose lives were of intense human interest. In my teens I encountered, thanks to their biographers, a saint, a mystic and a prophet. The saint was Saint Francis of Assisi, the mystic was Madame Guyon, and the prophet was Savonarola. I have related elsewhere how affected I was by the books The Little Flowers and The Life of Saint Francis, and how when I saw a beggar standing before me, I gave him all my money, just as Saint Francis might have done, except that Saint Francis probably would not have possessed any money. As so many have done, I delighted in his preaching to the birds, whom he called his little sisters, and his conversion of the fierce wolf of Gubbio. But Francis was no sentimental romantic. Poverty and humility were his two ideals, and he practiced both to the utmost extent. He spoke of himself as wedded to Lady Poverty, and the closeness of that union can be seen from his worn, patched tunic of the coarsest sackcloth, still preserved as a holy relic in an Italian church. At the same time, he was no sour ascetic. Until the end, when the order he had founded started to depart from his teaching, his life was one of joy. The nature of that joy is well illustrated by an episode in The Little Flowers, which is a book of stories about St. Francis. It was a winter's day, and St. Francis was going from Perugia with Friar Leo to St. Mary of the Angels, suffering sorely from the bitter cold. As they went, he called out to Friar Leo, who was walking before him, that even if the friars minor in every land were to give good example of holiness and edification, nevertheless he should write and note down diligently that perfect joy was not to be found therein. In the same way he called out to Friar Leo that perfect joy was not to be found in the Friar Minor's miracles of healing, nor in his knowing all the sciences and all the scriptures, nor in his speaking with the tongues of angels, nor in his preaching so well that he converted all the infidels to the faith of Christ, each time telling him to write down and note this diligently. When they had gone on for 2 good miles in this fashion, Friar Leo, in great wonder, prayed St. Francis in God's name to tell him where perfect joy was to be found. Francis answers him thus: "When we are come to St. Mary of the Angels, wet through with rain, frozen with cold, and foul with mire, and tormented with hunger, and when we knock at the doorkeeper cometh in rage and saith, 'Who are ye?' And we say, 'We are two of your friars.' And he answers, 'Ye tell not true, ye are rather two knaves that go deceiving the world and stealing the alms of the poor. Begone!' And he openeth not to us, and maketh us stay outside hungry and cold all night in the rain and snow. Then if we endure patiently such cruelty, such abuse, and such insolent dismissal, without complaint or murmuring, and believe humbly and charitably that that doorkeeper truly knows us, and that God maketh him to rail against us, O Friar Leo, right there is perfect joy." In other words, true joy did not depend on external conditions. It was even heightened when they were adverse. Reading this episode from The Little Flowers, again many years later, I was at once reminded of Tibet's great yogi Milarepa, who also was wedded to Lady Poverty, and who, wearing only a thin cotton robe, and sometimes not even that, sang songs of joy as he dwelt in the snowy mountains of his native land. Madame Jeanne-Marie Bouvier de la Motte-Guyon lived in the France of Louis XIV, and as an advocate of quietism, played a prominent, if controversial, part in the spiritual life of her country. The dictionary defines quietism as a form of religious mysticism requiring withdrawal of the spirit from all human effort and complete passivity to God's will. But for its opponents, it is the exaggeration and perversion of the mystical doctrine of interior quiet. I do not remember much of Upham's biography of Madame Guyon, which I have not seen since my impressionable teens, but I do remember at least one thing clearly. This was Madame Guyon's doctrine of pure or disinterested love, according to which one should love God purely, without hope for heaven or fear of hell, which was also the doctrine of certain Sufi mystics. As I subsequently learned from other sources, Madame Guyon suffered for her views. Despite the championship of Fénelon, the saintly Archbishop of Cambrai, she spent many years in prison, and eventually quietist teaching received papal condemnation. Like other forms of mysticism, quietism was perceived as dangerous by the religious authorities, for it made a spiritual life independent of the institutional church and its sacraments. Girolamo Savonarola was a Dominican friar, preacher and prophet who fell foul of the religious authorities in another way. Though the contemporary of Mantegna and Piero della Francesca, Botticelli and Leonardo da Vinci, he was no Renaissance man, but a throwback to the Middle Ages. Shocked by the corruption he saw in Florence, where he was prior of the monastery of San Marco, a corruption he believed was due to the city's wealth and to the discovery of the pagan classics, he delivered a series of passionate sermons in which he so terrified the people with predictions of the judgment to come if they did not mend their ways, that they drove out their cultivated Medici ruling family and established a Christian republic with Savonarola himself as spiritual dictator. During the carnival season of 1497, a great bonfire of vanities was held, in which personal ornaments, lewd pictures, cards and gaming tables were consigned to the flames. Botticelli, who had been deeply affected by the friar's preaching, is said to have contributed some of his own works to the Holocaust. But soon a reaction set in. People grew tired of having to be virtuous. Moreover, Savonarola had made political enemies both at home and abroad. These enemies joined forces with the Pope, the infamous Alexander VI, whom Savonarola had attacked in his sermons. In the end, the populace turned against him. Savonarola was arrested, tortured, and condemned. He can hardly be said to have been tried. 1 year after the bonfire of vanities, he was publicly hanged with his two close companions and his body burned. My second encounter with a saint, an uncanonized one, took place a few years later when I was in Singapore, and it took place through the medium of the little book of his sayings and letters that was put together after his death. The saint was Brother Lawrence of the Resurrection, a French Carmelite friar, who was an older contemporary of Madame Guyon, and author of the book The Practice of the Presence of God. Brother Lawrence was a simple man of humble birth who had been a soldier, a manservant, and a hermit before entering the Carmelite monastery in Paris, where he was employed as a cook. He was not a visionary, and perhaps not even a mystic, if to be a mystic is to experience ecstasies like those of Saint Teresa. His spiritual practice was to remain constantly aware of the presence of God, whatever he was doing. Though I did not make the comparison at the time, Brother Lawrence's practice of the presence of God was perhaps not dissimilar to the Buddhist practice of Buddhanusati, the constant recollection of the Buddha, with or without the repetition of his attributes or of a mantra. I did, however, write an article comparing certain aspects of Brother Lawrence's teaching with the yogas of the Bhagavad Gita, and the article was published in two installments in a Hindu religious magazine. I must have been quite touched by his sincerity and directness. Note, this article appears in Sangharakshita's recently published book called Early Writings. But touched though I was by Brother Lawrence's little book, it had no practical consequences for my own spiritual life as a Buddhist. Such was not the case with a book I was given by a Roman Catholic priest 4 or 5 years later. The book was called Seeds of Contemplation by the Irish-American Trappist monk Thomas Merton. At the time I was in India. I had recently become a Buddhist monk, and with my teacher, the Venerable Jagdish Kashyap, I was on pilgrimage to the Buddhist holy places of Bihar. One of them was Rajgir. There, besides visiting the site of the bamboo grove where the Buddha had often stayed, we called at the Roman Catholic Mission and had a friendly talk with the priest. When we left, he presented me with two books. One of them was Seeds of Contemplation. The rest of the story is best told in the words of my first volume of memoirs. The first volume of memoirs refers to the book The Rainbow Road, published by Windhorse Publications. For some time past, I had been greatly preoccupied with the question of ego, not only with the theoretical question of what it was or was not, but with the more practical one of how to get round it, or get rid of it, or get beyond it. Meditation did not seem enough. Something more drastic and more down-to-earth was needed, something that could be practiced every hour of the day, something that would provide a constant check to the unruly motions of the egoistic will. In Seeds of Contemplation, I found what I wanted, or at least a clear enough indication of it. The disciple should surrender his will absolutely to the will of his spiritual superior. In small matters, as in great, he should have no will of his own. Not even any personal wishes or preferences. This was the secret. This was the way to subjugate the ego, if not to destroy it completely. Though the idea was certainly not unfamiliar to me, it had never struck me so forcibly before, and I resolved to apply it henceforth to my relations with Kashyapji. In future, his wishes would be my law. I would have no wishes of my own. Whenever he asked me if I would like to do something, as in the goodness of his heart he often did, I would reply that I had no preference in that matter, and that we would do just as he wished. For the remainder of the time that we were together, I faithfully adhered to this resolution. As a result, I had no troubles and experienced a great peace of mind. The result was that when our pilgrimage over, Kashyapji took me up to Kalimpong, in the foothills of the eastern Himalayas, and instructed me to stay there and work for the good of Buddhism, I did just that. For the next 14 years, with Kalimpong as my headquarters, I worked for Buddhism, writing, teaching and lecturing in Kalimpong and the surrounding area, as well as in other parts of India. Only in 1964, with the blessing of Kashyapji and my other teachers, did I return to England, where I seemed to be more needed. I had not been long in England when I was introduced by Walter Nigg's book Warriors of God to 11 more saints, all of them founders of religious orders, and all canonized. It was a thoughtful, well-written book, and although the author, a Swiss Protestant clergyman, treated the founders sympathetically and tried to understand them, he could also be critical. They were very different from one another, and though all were officially saints, some were not very attractive characters. Saint Pachomius, the 4th century founder of the first Christian monastery, spoke contemptuously of Origen, the great Alexandrian theologian and philosopher, dismissing his writings as foolish chatter, and declaring that anyone who read his works and accepted his ideas would be consigned to the depths of hell. According to Pachomius's biographer, Pachomius could tell by a stranger's smell whether he was infected with Origen's heretical ideas, which makes him seem more like an African witch doctor than a Christian monk. St. Bernard of Clairvaux, the founder of the Cistercian order, who dominated the religious and political life of Western Europe for much of the 12th century, had an even keener nose for heresy than St. Pachomius. Heresy was everywhere, he complained bitterly towards the end of his life. No sooner was it stamped out in one place than it sprang up in another. He seems not to have understood that orthodoxy and heterodoxy were the obverse and reverse of the same coin, and that if there was orthodoxy, and if men had minds and could think, there would inevitably be heresy. Though Nigg has much to say about St. Bernard's mysticism and his intense devotion to the person of Christ, as exemplified by his eloquent sermons on the Song of Songs, he says little about his involvement in the Second Crusade. At the joint entreaty of the Pope and the King of France, he travelled through France and Germany, whipping up popular support for the enterprise with his oratory. Like his contemporaries, St. Bernard believed that fighting the infidel was an activity highly pleasing to God. In the event, the Second Crusade was a disaster. The Crusaders achieved nothing, and 9/10 of them lost their lives. For me, the most impressive of Nigg's warriors was St. Bruno of Cologne, and the Carthusian order, the most remarkable of the orders they had founded. A bitter experience of the simony that was endemic in the 11th century church convinced him of the vanity of the world, and he decided to become a monk. He seems also to have had a profound experience of the inevitability of death and the Last Judgment, and the certainty, if one had led only a nominally Christian life, of eternal damnation. The Benedictine monastery of Molemme in France, proving not strict enough for him, he settled with 6 companions in the wilds of the Dauphiné Mountains. There they built the first Carthusian monastery. Unlike the monks of other orders, they did not live conventually. Each monk had his or own separate cell, where he worked, prayed, and studied, and they met together only on Sunday. They rarely spoke. These verses from Ernest Dowson's poem entitled Carthusians well captures the spirit of Carthusian monastic life. Within their austere walls no voices penetrate, a sacred silence only, as of death, obtains. Nothing finds entry here of loud or passionate, this quiet is the exceeding profit of their pains. From many lands they came in diverse fiery ways. Each knew at last the vanity of earthly joys, and one was crowned with thorns, and one was crowned with bays, and each was tired at last of the world's foolish noise. It was not theirs with Dominic to preach God's holy wrath. They were too stern to bear sweet Francis's gentle sway. Theirs was a higher calling and a steeper path, to dwell alone with Christ, to meditate and to pray. A cloistered company, they are companionless. None knoweth here the secret of his brother's heart. They are but come together for more loneliness, whose bond is solitude, and silence all their part. The Carthusian order was remarkable for its never having been reformed. It had never been reformed because it had never become corrupted. In the case of other religious orders, a short initial period of rapid growth was usually followed by a much longer period of slow decline, after which it had to be revived or reformed. The Carthusians started modestly and continued steadily, and it was not until 200 years after St. Bruno's death that the order he had founded was really underway. After that, even the Great Schism could not halt it. According to Walter Nigg, the secret of Carthusian stability lay in the order's stern adherence to its ancient discipline. Connected with this was a concern for the quality rather than the quantity of its membership. In England, the Carthusians lasted until the dissolution of the monarchies under Henry VIII. Four monks of the London Charterhouse, including the prior, were executed in 1553 for treason on account of their refusal to repudiate the supremacy of the Pope and recognise the King as head of the Church in England. They died nobly, but I, for one, wish they could have died for a nobler cause than that of papal supremacy. The Roman Catholic Church naturally regards them as martyrs. In 1989, I was in Spain and happened to visit the Grand Cartuja on the outskirts of Granada, and I saw, hanging in the monastery's refectory, several large paintings depicting the arrest, trial, and execution of the unfortunate monks. As I wrote at the time, the paintings were well executed, and it was, in any case, interesting to see an episode from the history of Protestant England through Spanish Catholic eyes. Over the years, I became acquainted with many more saints, or so-called warriors of God, not all of them the founders of religious orders. I came to know them not through the biographies of disciples and latter-day admirers, or through their own writings, but more often through the paintings I saw in churches and art galleries. I did not always meet them under the best conditions. St. John the Baptist was being beheaded, as were St. Maurice and his 10,000 companions. St. Lawrence was being roasted on a gridiron. St. Agatha was having her breasts cut off. Sometimes I saw her holding them on a little dish. St. Sebastian, tied naked to a tree, was being shot at with arrows. And St. Erasmus was having his intestines drawn out with the help of a windlass. All this I found quite distasteful, especially when there was a lot of blood around. Christians seem to be rather fond of blood. Of course, St. John the Baptist and the rest had all been executed under the pagan Roman emperors, when executions were cruel and bloody affairs. So that if these martyrdoms were to be depicted at all, there would have to be at least a little blood. What was more, Jesus himself had been crucified, so that if the crucifixion too had to be depicted, it would have to be depicted similarly, with blood trickling from the hands and feet of the Saviour and from the wound in his side. However, as I moved from room to room of the art galleries and from period to period of European art, I noticed that as religious art became more realistic, it also tended to be more sanguinary. In early Christian art, there was no blood at all to be seen. Jesus hangs on the cross without a single drop of blood falling from his hands or feet or from the wound in his side. Sometimes he seems not to hang from the cross at all, but rather to be laid flat on the wood, without there being any tension. Sometimes he looks straight ahead. Even in the Middle Ages, when the emaciated body of Jesus twists in agony, and his head slumps to one side, the artists of the time were not preoccupied with the gory concomitants of the crucifixion. That preoccupation came later, reaching its apogee in some of the life-size polychrome figures of Spanish religious art. I once saw in a church in southern Spain a particularly gruesome example of the genre. Jesus has just been flogged prior to being crucified. He is naked except for a loincloth, and his body is streaming with blood. In the interest of greater verisimilitude, his loincloth is made of real cloth, and his hair and beard of real hair. Crudely realistic representations of the sufferings of Jesus, such as this, are meant to evoke a strong emotional response on the part of the spectator, whether one of horror or pity or indignation or devotion. They are also meant to make him feel guilty, for it is on account of his sins, together with those of the rest of mankind, that Jesus suffers. Saint Jerome was not a martyr, for he was born when Catholic or Orthodox Christianity had just become the official religion of the Roman Empire. Neither was he the founder of a religious order, though one was founded in his name many centuries after his death. We often met, especially in the course of my various Italian journeys of the 1980s, when I spent as much time as I could visiting the churches and art galleries of Florence and Siena, of Venice, Rome and Naples. Sometimes he appeared wearing, anachronistically, the broad-brimmed red hat and red robes of a cardinal, either alone or in the company of other saints. At other times he could be seen on his knees in the desert, performing penance for his sins, or seated in his peaceful study, or secluded cell, translating the scriptures. He performed his penance beneath blue skies, amidst magnificent mountain scenery, and in the shadow of fantastic rock formations. Besides the huge volumes from which he was translating, his study contained little more than a human skull and an hourglass, one reminding him of the inevitability of death, the other that time was passing and that not a moment should be wasted. Sometimes his cardinal's hat hangs on the wall. Whether outside or inside, he is attended by his faithful lion. I particularly liked seeing Saint Jerome when he was translating. There were times when he worked in almost total darkness, the page over which his bald head was bent, illumined by a single candle. There were times also when sunlight came streaming in through the window, lighting up every detail of the place. The more I saw of Saint Jerome in his study, translating, the more I felt drawn to him. I was drawn to him not just as an interesting historical personality who, after a varied career as teacher, traveller, hermit, pilgrim and secretary to the reigning Pope, had left Rome out of disgust at the corruption of the Roman clergy and made his way to the Holy Land, there to spend the rest of his life in literary activity. Rather, I was drawn to him on account of what he represented or embodied. With his long white beard and venerable appearance, for me he was the embodiment of the wise old man, one of Jung's archetypes of the collective unconscious. That he was engaged in the work of translating, especially that of rendering the Word of God as contained in the Hebrew of the Old Testament and the Greek of the New, into Latin, the lingua franca of the Roman world, meant that something hidden in the depths was being brought to the surface and the light of day. A sonnet I wrote on St. Jerome in 1967, a year after my first Italian journey, concludes with the following lines. In a world of sin, the empire changes hands. The churches fight, factious as dogs. By day, the old man, stung, magnificently answers Augustine. Then, dredging from the deep, night after night, translates the word into the vulgar tongue. Because St. Jerome was, quote, dredging from the deep, he was the alchemist, another embodiment of the wise old man, and his study was the alchemist's laboratory, where lead was transmuted into gold. No doubt I was drawn to St. Jerome partly because of my personal situation at the time. As I explain in a paper written in the course of my 1984 Italian journey, I was living in the desert. I had left the, quote, Rome of collective, official, even establishment Buddhism, and was seeking to return to the origins of Buddhism in the actual life and experience of the Buddha and his immediate disciples. Not only that, I was trying to teach Buddhism in the West, which meant I was trying to communicate the spirit of the Dharma in terms of Western rather than in terms of Eastern culture. I was thus a translator, with all that implies in the way of seeking to fathom the uttermost depths of what one is trying to translate so that one may translate it faithfully, that is, bring its meaning to the surface, or from darkness into light. Thus, I was drawn to the image of Saint Jerome, and was able to see that image as an embodiment of the archetype of the wise old man as translator and alchemist, because I had a personal affinity with that image, or because there was something in me that corresponded to that image. Although Saint Jerome is regarded as a saint, in certain respects he was not a very saint-like person. A Christian scholar says of him, quote, "He was passionate and sensuous, yet he was the champion of the most rigid asceticism. Full of petty vanity and learned rivalry, he was self-assertive and unjust to his opponents. And though destitute of the creative theologian's gift, he liked to pose as a pillar of orthodoxy." End of quote. Nonetheless, St. Jerome's historical importance cannot be denied. And the same authority therefore continues, quote, "By his translation of the Bible, he exercised an immense influence upon the succeeding centuries, and in that work he produced what must be numbered among the supreme achievements of the Christian mind in any age." End of quote. Despite his being the champion of rigid asceticism, Saint Jerome seems to have been more scholar and litterateur than saint. There could be no doubting the saintliness of Saint Catherine of Siena, who impressed me as much as Saint Jerome, though not as the embodiment of an archetype, but as a remarkable human being. She was born in Siena, the city of the Palio, or Banner, in 1347. On account of its romantic hilltop situation, and the fact that within its walls it remained essentially a medieval town, it was my favourite Italian city, and I visited it a number of times. I loved the Tuscan Gothic cathedral with its colourful ornate façade, its bands of black and white marble on walls and pillars, its unique marble mosaic floor, and its many art treasures, including Duccio's My Star. I loved the shell-shaped main piazza with its fountain by Jacopo della Quercia, the lofty bell tower of the flanking city hall, and the gentle almond-eyed saints and virgins who thronged the churches and the city art gallery. I also loved the grass-grown city walls, the cavernous shops, open-fronted like those in India, and the steep cobbled streets, in one of which I found, on my first visit to Siena, the house in which St. Catherine had been born to a prosperous dyer and his wife, as the last but one of their 25 children. Every room in the house had been turned into a chapel or oratory, with coffered ceilings and frescoed walls, and on what once had been the family's kitchen garden, there stood a Baroque church. As a small child, Catherine was of a lively, affectionate disposition, but when she was 7 or 8, she had her first vision, and a change took place. She became silent and withdrawn, and devoted herself to prayer and penance. This displeased her parents, who sought by various means, both gentle and harsh, to induce her to give up her austerities. They desisted only when her father, entering her room one day when she was kneeling in prayer, saw a pure white dove on her head, an incident depicted in one of the frescoes, along with others relating to her early life. When Catherine was 16, she was received as a penitent of the Third Order of Saint Dominic, and henceforth wore the black and white habit of the order. She continued to live at home, occupying the tiny room that had become her cell, and giving herself up to a life of extreme austerity, not to say self-mortification. On leaving the house and sanctuary of Saint Catherine, as the complex was called, I made my way up the steep acclivity that led to the tall, brick-built Dominican church that occupied the top of the hill, dominating the narrow streets below. The first thing I saw on entering the building was the preserved head of the saint, behind glass, high up on the wall, it having been separated from her body shortly after her death and sent to Siena from Rome, where she had died and where her body was still preserved. In the gloom of the church, it was just possible to make out the features. More appealing than this grisly relic was the portrait by Andrea Vanni, a friend and admirer of the saint, that hung in a little chapel to which the saint had often come to pray, and where she had been received as a penitent. She wore the white robe and black mantle of the order, the white symbolising innocence and the black humility. In her left hand she held a lily, while her right hand was presented to a female votary kneeling at her feet, who seemed about to kiss her fingers. The expression with which the saint looked down at the votary was calm and thoughtful. There are other paintings in the chapel, all of them depicting scenes from Catherine's life, and all by Bazzi, also known as Sodoma. The most beautiful of them depicted the saint being supported by two nuns as she swoons in ecstasy, overcome by some mystical experience. It seemed incredible that this slight, delicate young woman, with what the Victorian author of a sketch taken from Vanni's portrait described as, quote, a spare, worn, but elegant face with small, regular features, should not only have engaged in the most fearsome austerities, in the midst of which she experienced both spiritual raptures and terrible, diabolical temptations, but should also have played, for 8 years of her short life, a central, even pivotal, part in the religious and political life of Italy. In the middle of the 14th century, much of Italy was in turmoil. There were wars between rival city-states, as well as bitter, bloody, internecine strife in the case of some of them, including Siena. Roving bands of mercenaries plundered and looted, and there was the arrival from the east of the Black Death, with its appalling economic and social consequences. The turmoil extended to the church. Morals were lax, not least among the higher clergy, and simony and nepotism were rife. Worst of all, in 1308, the reigning pope had moved from Rome to Avignon in France, and at the time of Catherine's birth, the papacy had been based there for 40 years, with the result that Rome, no longer the capital of Christendom, had become a city of ruins, haunted by thieves and murderers. It was into this turmoil that Catherine threw herself when, at the age of 25, she began what she called her mission to the world. By this time, a small band of disciples had formed around her, and she had gained a widespread reputation for sanctity. Her mission began with an impassioned letter to a leading cardinal, the Pope's representative in Italy, in which she sang the praises of charity, in the sense of selfless love of others, as the true foundation of social harmony and political stability. That Italy should be at peace was her greatest earthly desire. When Gregory the 11th called for a crusade against the Muslims, she therefore gave the idea her enthusiastic support, apparently seeing it as a means of ridding Italy of the marauding mercenary bands, and wrote to princes and prelates all over Europe, urging them to take up the cross. Neither princes nor prelates wanted to take part in the crusade, however, and preparations for the enterprise never got off the ground. Catherine realised that peace would come to Italy only if the Pope returned to Rome. And in the course of a visit to Avignon, she was able to persuade him, despite strong opposition from the French cardinals, to take this momentous step. In 1377, amid general rejoicing, Gregory entered the Eternal City and took up residence in the Vatican, thus bringing to an end the papacy's so-called Babylonian captivity in Avignon. A year later he died, to be succeeded by Urban VI. The new pope had been elected under duress, the Romans having threatened to kill the cardinals if they did not give them a Roman, or at least an Italian pope. And it was not long before a group of cardinals met at nearby Fundi and elected another pope, Clement VII. Christendom now had two popes, and later would have three, each anathematizing and excommunicating the two others and their adherents. Catherine regarded Urban as the true pope and did her utmost to persuade the adherents of Clement to accept him as such. Amid these stirring events, she reconciled deadly enemies, comforted the sick and bereaved, and consoled the dying, as she had done ever since leaving her cell for the world. In this connection, there occurred, towards the end of the saint's life, an incident which strikingly illustrates her character. Nicola di Tondo, a young Perugian noble, had been unjustly sentenced to death by the government of Siena for uttering some rash words against the state. Mad with despair, he refused to make his confession or to listen to a word about the salvation of his soul. But when Catherine visited him in his cell and spoke to him, he calmed down and accepted his fate. She was with him to the last, as she had promised him she would be, and received his severed head into her hands as it fell from the block. Then, to her ecstatic gaze, the heavens seemed to open, and she saw the Saviour, in likeness like the sun, receive the victim's blood into his own open wounds. In 1378, having finished dictating her dialogue, a mystical treatise, the saint left Siena for Rome, where she was received with great honour by Urban, and where she helped reorganise the church. 2 years later, still living in Rome, she died, worn out by her austerities and her labours in the cause of peace. She was 33. In 1461, she was canonised by Pius II, a fellow Sienese. The event is commemorated in one of the brilliant frescoes with which Pinturicchio, with the assistance of the young Raphael, decorated the walls of the Piccolomini Library in Siena Cathedral. Wearing the papal tiara, his right hand raised, Pius sits enthroned aloft beneath the canopy, flanked by his red-robed cardinals. The body of Catherine, habited in the penitent's white and black, lies stretched out on a catafalque at his feet, her head slightly raised. Below in the foreground, monks, nuns, and laypeople stand holding lighted tapers. Today, St. Catherine of Siena's body lies behind glass beneath the high altar of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, one of the finest of the old basilica churches of Rome. I have twice seen her there, and it seemed to me that there emanated from her, in death as in life, that same fragrant purity of which one of her disciples spoke. St. Bridget of Sweden had died in Rome 7 years before St. Catherine did. She lived there for 23 years. Unlike St. Catherine, she had been married and had children before becoming a nun, and unlike the Italian saint, she had founded a religious order, that of the Sisters of the Most Holy Saviour, or the Brigittines. In other respects, these two saints were very much alike. St. Bridget, too, had practised severe austerities, had seen visions and received revelations. Many of the revelations related to the corruption of the times, especially the corruption of the church, and called for reform. Some called for the return of the Pope from Avignon to Rome, a cause for which St. Bridget worked as enthusiastically as St. Catherine did after her, if with less success. Her visionary experiences included a vision of the crucified Saviour, which influenced her whole life and outlook. She seems to have been more visionary than mystic, and more prophetess than visionary, receiving from God messages in which princes and prelates were threatened with dire consequences if they did not mend their ways. As a visionary, she cannot be compared with a fellow countryman of hers who lived 500 years later, in whose name there was founded, after his death, not a religious order, but a new church, the Church of the New Jerusalem. Swedenborg was born in Stockholm in 1688 and died in London in 1772. He had a distinguished career as a scientist, philosopher, and civil servant, in the course of which he had published a number of works of a philosophical or scientific nature, some of them quite substantial. But in 1744, when he was 55, a dramatic change took place. One night God appeared to him in his room in the form of a man. He had chosen him to declare to men the spiritual contents of Scripture, he told Swedenborg, and he himself would tell him what he should write on the subject. Then that same night, Swedenborg's spiritual eyes were opened, and he was enabled to have conscious perception of the spiritual world and its inhabitants. Thereafter, Swedenborg gave up all worldly pursuits and devoted himself entirely to writing about his travels in the spiritual world, where he met and conversed with angels, deceased human beings, and devils, and to explaining the true spiritual meaning of the Bible in the light of the principle of correspondences, according to which everything in the material world had its counterpart in the spiritual world. Probably the best known of Swedenborg's theological writings is Heaven and Its Wonders and Hell, from Things Heard and Seen, which I read when I was 15 in a Penguin paperback edition. I cannot remember what I made of it then. I think I read it in the same spirit in which I read Paradise Lost and The Divine Comedy, both of which had much to say about the inhabitants of the spiritual world, both celestial and infernal. Swedenborg was buried in the Swedish church in London, but in 1908 the Swedish government had his remains removed to Uppsala Cathedral, where they were deposited in a magnificent sarcophagus of Swedish red granite. The last time I was in Sweden, I visited Uppsala, and in the gloom of the cathedral had a glimpse of the dull red bulk of the sarcophagus behind its protecting iron grille. The lives of Swedenborg and Blake overlapped by 35 years. William Blake was born in 1757, and it was in this year, according to Swedenborg, that the Last Judgment took place. It took place not on earth, but in the spiritual world, when all who had lived from the beginning of creation were gathered together and judged, and when a new church was instituted in the heavens. Blake was familiar with Swedenborg's writings and annotated his own copies of several of them. Though he spoke highly of Swedenborg, calling him a divine teacher, and though he adopted or adapted many of Swedenborg's ideas, he did not hesitate to criticise him drastically or even to parody him in one of his own works. Both Blake and Swedenborg were visionaries, with this difference, that Blake not only communicated his visions in words, but could also draw and paint them. Blake cannot be described as a saint or a mystic in the Christian sense of those terms, nor was he a Christian in any sense other than that which he himself attached to the word. With Blake, as with Swedenborg to a lesser degree, we pass from the Christian to the post-Christian era of European history. In the 60s and 70s, I found in his poetry and his art, as well as in his life, a source of great inspiration, as did many others in those heady days. As I wrote at the time, a whole century before Buddhism was really known in the West, Blake offers us the unique example of a non-theistic, imaginative vision of rare intensity and integrity. That he could do this was due, in the first place, to his own extraordinary creative powers, powers which manifested early, and of which he remained in unimpaired possession to the end of his days, he being faithful to them, and they being faithful to him.